Hey, I'm Tom Power. I'm the host of the podcast Q with Tom Power, where we talk to all kinds of artists, actors, writers, musicians, painters. We had Green Day on the other day talking about their huge album, American Idiot. Nicole Byer came on to talk about ADHD and comedy. And then there's Dan Levy. While we were talking about filmmaking, we talked about his insecurities.
I sometimes feel like I have this desire to, like, perform, to be a version of myself that people might like.
Listen to Q with Tom Power to hear your favorite artists as they truly are, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This is Spark. Tell me, what does it mean to be human in this particular technological moment? It can seem like conventional measures of what's true, permanent, and, well, human are up for grabs in the face of rapidly advancing tech. And if there's no special spark that truly separates us from other animals or our technological creations, does it matter? That's what we'll try to answer in our 10-part series, Being Human Now. This time, music. Music is one of those things we think of as a uniquely human experience. The activity of both creating and enjoying it is recorded throughout history and spans physical and conceptual borders, from lullabies to hymns to dance songs. Now, though, generative AI tools have inspired a fear, or at least a worry, that machines are encroaching on this human experience of music creation and performance. But these worries aren't as new or unique as we might think.
Concerns about what machines will do to humans and to music have been circulating since the mid-1700s, I would say, and were very intense during the 19th century and 20th century and continuing up to today. I'm Deirdre Lockridge. I'm a musicologist and an associate professor at Northeastern University.
Deirdre's research looks at the history of music and technology, our relationship with the tools used to make music, and how that relationship speaks to our current times.
My new book is Sounding Human, Music and Machines, 1740-2020. It's about how the ideas of human and machine have been shaped and contested through music.
In her book, she argues that when it comes to the story of music, it's never been human or machine, but human with machine. Music-making tools and musical artifacts have long been used to rework our understanding of what it is to be human, and they continue to do so. She begins her book by describing a game that composer David Cope introduced back in 2001.
So, David Cope created a computer program to be able to compose music in the style of other composers, so Chopin as an example, and then he plays this game asking listeners, can you tell which of these examples is the human-composed, the Chopin-composed music versus the computer-composed music? And generally, listeners cannot accurately tell which is which. And so what does that mean? For David Cope, a really important point this makes is that creativity is really combinatorial and is something that computers and humans can do instead of a uniquely human capacity. But another thing we can use this game to think about is the framing of it. Why is it set up as human composed or machine composed when the computer program was created by a person who was using previously composed music to create that program? And even with the case of Chopin, that he was creating music at a piano, which has frequently been described as one of the most complex machines of the 19th century. And so really, on both sides, you have human and machine composed music. And so thinking about the way the two have worked together and continue to work together instead of to set them up in opposition to each other.
Deirdre's work looks at this framing, what she calls the human-machine boundary, and how it came to be over the course of music history. She starts her investigation in the 18th century.
one of the events of the 18th century was the invention of what becomes referred to as an android, that it looks like a human playing the flute in the case of this early invention by Jacques Maupassant in Paris in 1737. Encounters with this machine that plays the flute have been very provocative of these questions of what does it take to create music? Does it require the performer to feel the music? Is intelligence required? Observing a machine play music perhaps suggests these things are not required. Though significantly, I look at that moment around 1740 for what the first reactions to this flute playing machine were. Mm-hmm. And they were primarily very positive. This is such an amazing, a pleasurable thing to experience. And it's really over time, as increasingly the issues of colonialism and questioning what a person or a human is in this broader context come together, that it starts to become a figure of anxiety, something that's really unsettling for people to confront.
Deirdre's book connects the rise of colonialism and enslavement with an increasing anxiety about specifying human qualities. She writes that in the second half of the 18th century, the rise of cultural differences resulting from travels around the globe, colonial expansion into the Americas, the bringing of enslaved people from Africa, then brought to the forefront questions about what it means to be a human, and who is considered human and who isn't. The unfamiliar human-looking flute-playing automaton, which was touring Europe at that time, became a reminder of those questions, and a boundary between humans and machines began to form. Moving forward in time, the solid line between human and machine blurs in the second half of the 20th century, when we first encounter the cyborg. The idea of the human-machine blend emerged from the post-World War II field of cybernetics, but it had broader cultural impacts as an alternative to the automaton or the robot, and that had powerful creative effects on music.
By this time in the mid to late 20th century, robots represent this completely non-human, like autonomous entity. And then the cyborg introduces this other possibility. It has robot elements, but really they are combined with a human. In the original context for that term, it was about enabling humans to go to space and the kind of equipment they would need to be able to survive in an environment inhospitable to humans. And so that opens up some other ways of breaking down the binary between human and machine, that they can actually be symbiotic, be in fusion with each other, and be part of changing the conversation about what we think new machines and technologies do to us or as we encounter them.
Mm-hmm. And you can think about bands like, you know, Kraftwerk as an obvious example of this kind of not just being the machine and the human, but actually embracing the blurring of human sound and the machine. And early Detroit techno people often talk about it in the same way. Also, where it's actually opening up a kind of creative potential, no?
Yes, yes. There's really strong traditions in electronic music of being fascinated by the machine, the regularity of the beat, these kinds of musical elements that are very signifying of a machine type being, and that being fun and cool and great for dancing. Mm-hmm. And then there's other strands that are maybe more challenging what the machine in music means. Like, does it mean this rigid, repetitive? Are those the qualities of the machine? Or in fact, can machines have very other qualities? Can machines be expressive as well?
Mm-hmm. So how does looking at the history of music and technology help us make sense of our current relationship to technology?
I think it's common with technology and machines to wed them to the new, to think this new technology is changing things in ways that get interpreted in extremes. Either this is the key to democratizing, or this is going to fix our problems, or extreme concerns that this is going to take away our humanity. It's going to have all kinds of detrimental consequences. And looking at the history can help us see the many moments of new technologies entering the picture and the debates that surrounded them and the benefits and the downsides that people recognized at the time of them being new that then over time kind of fade away as that technology becomes normal, just part of the everyday. We could think of musical instruments as a really exemplary case of this, where, I mean, earlier I mentioned the piano being a machine, but for us today, is that how we typically think of the piano mm-hmm. as a mechanical contraption? Probably not.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in the book, you show how over the course of history, musicians have viewed instruments as kind of extensions of the body or even collaborators in the creative process. Can you talk about that a little bit?
There's a chapter in the book on pianos going to the dump. And what reaction does that provoke when we see a piano simply being discarded, thrown off the back of a truck into a trash heap? For some people, it is just another object. What's the big deal? For others, especially people who have grown up with a piano in the home and spent many hours practicing on one, it can feel really wrong. And people describe it feeling more like a family pet or a relative, really person kind of status, which really speaks to the ability of music to forge that kind of bond, that connection to an object, to something non-human. And so one way of thinking about musical instruments is as extensions of the body, extensions of the self. The violin is an instrument that comes to mind in that mold. And so the idea there is the performer's soul is extended through the instrument and is being expressed through it. But with the case of the piano going to the dump, it seems more like the piano has its own soul. And in fact, people debate, like, where is the soul of the piano? The soundboard is one popular answer, but it's also been other parts of the piano, even the pedals. And so with musical instruments, we also have this history of how these human qualities are imparted to them, are kind of attributed to or recognized in them as one of the other kind of facets to think about in our relationship to machines and technologies in general.
Yeah. I mean, what does that show us about the porousness of the line between the human and the machine when it comes to music?
Well, a question it raises is what sorts of objects or technologies can sustain this kind of relationship, this interaction? And so within classical musical world, it has been common to think it's the acoustic instruments, it is the violins and the pianos that we can have this relationship to. Oh, the digital, no, there's no soul in the digital piano. That would be impossible. And assuming that it is a inherent in the kind of object that it is, that this category of digital instruments or software instruments would not be able to have a soul in the same way. But in fact, what we learn from musicians who work with those kinds of tools is that they too can develop that same kind of connection and finding those kinds of qualities in these something like digital tools as well.
So you start in 1740 in the book, but you end with this coda, which is looking at the 2020s and more contemporary examples of humans and machines making music. So can you talk to me a bit about this moment we're in when it comes to that conversation around the human-machine boundary? Like, what stage are we at right now?
We are definitely seeing AI doing things that not very long ago didn't seem so possible that machine could do them, especially around creativity, which has really been one of the human capacities that often is thought of as uniquely human, something that we can hold on to no matter what technology might do. It'll never have this ability to create the new. And I think recent developments like ChatGPT and similar products on the music side do, rather like David Cope's game, kind of re-ask these questions of what machines are capable of and then what that means for us when machines prove capable of things we didn't realize mm-hmm. they would be.
Yeah. Deirdre, thanks so much for your insights on this.
Thank you for having me on the show. It's been a delight.
Deirdre Lockridge is the author of Sounding Human, Music and Machines, 1740-2020. And she's an associate professor of music at Northeastern University.
You are listening to Spark.
The microphone does not share your interests and preoccupations, and that can be both wonderfully revealing, but also incredibly frustrating.
This is Spark
with Nora Young on CBC Radio.
Now, as we heard from Deirdre, looking at the history of music can help us make sense of our current relationship to technology. But what happens when a musician performs music so otherworldly that people begin to speculate whether the human being is actually a machine? For that story, we need the CBC's top spinner of musical tales, Tom Allen.
Life in London in the late 18th century was nothing at all like life today, except for one thing: change. 18th century Londoners saw massive changes, both in the size and structure of their city and at home. Before 1760, if a person needed fabric for clothes, they would go to the weaver's house. A loom was a loom, and everybody knew how it worked. Then came the mechanical spinning wheel. It made twice as much yarn in half the time. Then a mechanical loom, twice as much again, and then rows of them in sprawling factories. And what used to take days now took minutes. Machines became part of daily life. So in 1765, when word spread through London of a young boy from Austria who could play with almost inhuman ease, the idea that this child might in fact be a miraculous machine wasn't so far-fetched at all.
Pure wizardry.
The boy was Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. He was 8 years, 5 months old by the time a noted scientist, urged by the suspicions of those around him, resolved to establish whether young Mozart was in fact an automaton or an adult in a boy's body.
Incredible.
Daines Barrington was a lawyer, a naturalist, and a founder of the Royal Society. The report of his interview with Mozart in June of 1765 is highly entertaining. He makes it clear that several around him doubted Papa Mozart's claims that the boy, if we can call him that, was only eight.
Impossible.
But Barrington was quickly convinced. Mozart showed astounding abilities. He improvised pieces with structural cohesion, with taste and beauty. He read from an opera score that he'd never seen before, five different lines, all in different clefs,
incredible,
playing the accompaniment, singing the top parts, and correcting his father, who missed a few notes in the bass.
It's a genius.
But even as he did all that, Barrington also reports,
"While he was playing for me, a favorite cat came in, and he immediately left his harpsichord to play with the cat and refused to return."
That settled it. He was no automaton.
Told you so.
But the idea of machines making music persisted and grew until one of history's most engaging hucksters took that idea to town. 1815, in the musical capital of Vienna, one morally flexible man found a way into the heart of the era. Johann Nepomuk Maltzel was known as an inventor, but mostly he was an opportunist, and his various automatons, most of which he bought from less enterprising inventors, were successful because people genuinely wanted to believe that a machine could play the trumpet, as one of his did, or could defeat Napoleon in a game of chess, as another did, or gather up the sounds of a military band and have them available in one cabinet-sized machine filled with horns and reeds and pipes and drums and cannons. That was the Panharmonicon, a true-to-life mechanical military band that gave the population and the era exactly what it wanted.
Huzzah!
Maltzel's Panharmonicon has not survived. And there is some question exactly how it sounded, but it did do enough music making and music selling that at least one great composer wrote something for it, and that was Ludwig van Beethoven. Maltzel promised Beethoven great riches if he would write a masterpiece for the Panharmonicon. But things went wrong when Beethoven took him at his word and wrote an enormous piece that was just too much for the poor machine to play. The friendship between the two suffered when no money was earned, but to be fair to Maltzel, Beethoven's composition wasn't exactly a masterpiece either. It's called Wellington's Victory. If you've ever wondered what a bad piece by a great composer sounds like, here you go.
We'll be right back.
Wellington's victory is generally agreed to be the worst thing that Beethoven wrote. But Maltzel sold it as hard as he sold everything else, and it also paved the way for one of the era's truly successful collaborations between human and machine. The machine was the metronome. You'll read that Maltzel invented it. He didn't. He copied one made by the Dutch inventor Dietrich Winckel, patented it, and mass-produced it under the name Maltzel's metronome. And along the way, he showed it to Beethoven, who loved it. Before the metronome, if you were a composer, the only way you could indicate how your music should be played was through a series of vague word instructions. Allegro, which could mean cheerful, or quickly, or both. Largo, which could mean slow or very slow, and presto, which could mean right away or very quickly, but not as quickly as prestissimo. Deciding what those words mean is like ordering chicken vindaloo and asking the server, how hot is hot? You're basically on your own. But the metronome allowed the discerning composer to indicate precisely how quickly their music should be played with the definitive so many beats per minute designation. Once in possession of a metronome, Beethoven went through several of his most important pieces and said exactly how quickly or slowly they should be played, a tremendous gift to centuries of musicians to follow, right? Well, the thing is that by the time he got his metronome, Beethoven was almost completely deaf. So what he was dictating in terms of speed wasn't what people could play, but what he was hearing in his own aural imagination. And the speeds he wrote down were, to many musicians, so difficult and so beyond what seemed sensible, most simply didn't believe he really meant it.
It's absurd.
For the next 200 years, many musicians, from amateurs to pros, just ignored Beethoven's instruction.
No one can play this music.
Even though he'd employed a scientific measurement still in use today to say exactly what he wanted. They said his metronome was faulty. They said he misunderstood how the markings worked. They said, as many did in his own time, that he was starting to lose his mind. But Beethoven knew what he wanted. And sure enough, close to 200 years later, a string quartet in Toronto, the Eibler Quartet, followed his instructions. It took them 4 years, gradually ticking up the metronome speeds until they could get there, but they did it. Maltzel didn't live to see that. He toured his fraudulent chess-playing robot and stayed a boot tip ahead of the law until he was found dead of alcohol poisoning in a Venezuelan harbor in 1838. And the metronome, like the loom before it, is hardly recognizable now. It went from clockworks with a pendulum to an electric pulse to an app you can use so easily it's hard to believe anyone ever had to think about it. But thinking and believing, it turns out, is our side of the transaction when it comes to working with machines. And until people believe it, very little changes at all.
Tom Allen is a storyteller, trombonist, and the host of CBC Music's daily program, About Time. This summer, you can catch his touring show, J.S. Bach's Long Walk in the Snow, in performances across Ontario and Nova Scotia.
I'm Nala Ayed, host of Ideas. In this age of clickbait and online shouting, Ideas is a meeting ground for people who want to deepen their understanding of the world. Join me as we crack open a concept to see how it plays out over place and time, and how it matters today. From the rise of authoritarianism to the history of cult movies, no idea is off limits. Ideas is on the CBC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
I'm Nora Young, and this time on Spark, another in our occasional series, Being Human Now. That's where we look at facets of human existence that we once took to be distinctly ours and how they're changing in today's technological moment. This time, the uniquely human activity, or is it, of making music. Earlier in the show, we heard how instruments like the piano and the violin have historically served as extensions of the human artist and even been perceived as having a soul, particularly in the classical music world. So what about when it comes to digital instruments and software?
My name is Gil Wong. I'm an associate professor at Stanford University in music as well as computer science. I'm also a faculty associate director of Stanford's Institute on Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence as well as a senior fellow there.
Guy is a computer music pioneer who's worked with AI over the course of his career. So he sees creative power and potential in using it, but even he has reservations about the current uses of the technology in music. He's worked as part musician, part computer scientist for over two decades now. From the age of seven, he's played conventional instruments like the guitar, accordion, and ukulele, and less conventional ones, too.
Here, I have Ocarina, which is an app designed in 2008 for the phone. And the way you play it is you blow into the microphone on the bottom of the phone. I'm holding my phone like a sandwich, and I'm using multi-touch to control the pitch. So I'm going to play a scale by blowing into my iPhone here. And vibrato is controlled by the tilt of the phone, right? You know, kind of using our bodies to, like, create physical instruments with technology. Here's a little ditty. For example.
Ga designed Ocarina using a programming language he created in 2003 called Chuck, which synthesizes sound and creates wacky, whimsical computer music, instruments, and toys.
Sounds that, you know, we often wouldn't hear or wouldn't be feasible to have, like, outside of the medium of the computer. So you can use this programming language, write code, and out comes sound. And sound that is controllable, sound that is sometimes otherworldly, a sound that's something we can hope to sculpt and craft through code into something musical. Everything from, yeah, the bleeps and bloops to physical models of instruments. Instruments that we try to model the physics of with using software and digital signal processing, and then be able to control how the sound is output to any number of other techniques that we can use to generate computerized sound or to process sound that we have.
In 2008, using that real-time sound synthesis and music creation, he formed something delightfully called Slork, or the Stanford Laptop Orchestra, and it's still going strong.
The Stanford Laptop Orchestra consists of, well, laptops, anywhere between 6 to 20 laptops at a time, set out on the stage. Each laptop is paired with usually one human being and a special hemispherical speaker array that looks like the top half of, like, the robot R2-D2 from Star Wars. Now, these hemispherical speaker arrays have 6 speakers on them, and the purpose of that is to keep the sound that's made by the laptop local to that laptop and to that human performer. In this sense, the laptop orchestra could fill out an entire stage, maybe with 20 laptop stations of laptops, humans, and these hemispherical speaker arrays. But in that sense, it's actually both trying to capture what computers are good at doing, which is creating sounds that we otherwise might not have, but also preserving and perhaps exploring something that we love and cherish about traditional acoustic instruments, which is, well, the acoustics. In the laptop orchestra, the idea is that we don't have loudspeakers around the performance area, but we have speakers that are next to each performer. So especially if you're sitting close, you can identify, oh, where is that sound coming from? And this actually changes the kind of instruments you would design for the laptop orchestra. Does it change what kind of sounds and what kind of music you might write with those instruments? It would change how you perform, and as an audience, it would change how you would listen. So it's a lot of technology, but it's also trying to preserve something we love about acoustics and traditional acoustic instruments.
So does that mean it gives you sort of the spatial sense that you get when you're listening to a conventional acoustic orchestra where, you know, the oboe's over here and the bass is over there, kind of that type of a spatial feeling of listening to music?
That's exactly right. And we perform in different sizes. So at a large scale, it is exactly as you described. It's like a full orchestra setup where you're in a concert hall and you're saying, yes, the oboe's over there. And there's a harp over there. There's percussion, strings, there's woodwinds. And then there's the smaller venues that's more akin to chamber music. So it's a kind of electronic chamber music, a term I would attribute to one of my professors at Princeton when I was a grad student there some 20 years ago. And I was very fortunate to be actually a teaching assistant, but also developing the technology, including Chuck, that was used in the laptop orchestra. And Dan Truman actually, I think, coined this term electronic chamber music, combining, again, the possibility of computers and the sense of space we might have from an intimate performance.
Yeah. In your 2018 book, Artful Design, you explore this idea of what we make makes us. I'm wondering if you could reflect on that, given our current moment when we have so many AI tools specifically for music generation.
When we make that technology, we should try to reflect and think as broadly as possible about the implications of what might happen. Not just what if it went wrong. That's also good to think about, but like, what if it actually worked? And people actually use the stuff we built. What does that do to people, you know, as individuals and communities? And so what we make makes us says that the things we make today kind of will come back like a boomerang. And knowing that, how do we try our best to design, not just intelligently, but like, I guess, wisely?
Yeah. So can you have a sense of what AI-generated music, what the impacts are, how that makes us, or is it still too early to know?
You know, it's both too early to know, but also things are moving so fast that I wonder if we as humans will even give ourselves a chance to actually reflect on a thing before the thing has become another thing. So if we apply this idea of what we make makes us with AI-generated music, I think there are a lot of questions about. One is something that I've asked myself for 20 years, which is why?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm interested in this question of what we want with the technologies that we're building in music. Like, it's unlike with computers and music, with AI, it sort of seems like we're outsourcing it rather than just using it as a tool or instrument. I mean, but is that just my, you know, naive way of thinking about it? How do you think about it?
You know, I don't think it's naive at all. I think as a musician, I think there's an abiding belief that maybe the point of music is that we make it. And what that statement says is that, you know, it's easy to think about music as like a result or a product, a song that we have and we can listen to and it maybe entertains us. I think the real artful songs, they also understand us. But as a musician, it's actually like not just the product, it's a process. The process matters so much because that's the real fun part, is that when you've learned a craft to the point where you can now begin to be creative with it. And you work hard at it. It's like climbing a mountain. It's not supposed to be easy. And in fact, if it was too easy, it kind of loses the actual sublime joy of actually working at a thing. And so that even if you have the result, it actually is not the same meaning, you know, and potentially less meaningful.
Mm. So considering all that we've discussed, how would you describe what AI-mediated music creation is? What does that look like?
We're actually using AI to build wacky, playful, interactive tools. So when you can use AI to then create like an instrument that isn't trying to learn you, but actually, you know, uses some kind of machine intelligence to help you be interactive. I think that's the kind of goal we're looking for. You know, as one of my students put eloquently, in general, when it comes to music, if AI is used as part of your process, as part of your craft, that can be good. But if AI is used primarily to get the result, that's generally not as interesting. And so, again, it comes back to this process versus product. You know, the AI is doing work, but the things are interesting because the humans are interesting. And they have to actually put their effort into working with the systems they've actually built. They have to then learn the system as you would learn any other instrument.
I'm Nora Young. Today we're talking about designing digital music tools that can artfully balance machine automation and human interaction. Right now, my guest is musician and computer scientist Ga Wong. So Rolling Stone recently released a song called Soul of the Machine on Suno using the prompt Mississippi Delta Blues song about a sad AI, which subsequently went viral. So what was your first impression and reaction of listening to this song?
I think initial impression is like, wow, I am impressed on a technical level. But then as I start to sit with it, it's everything else that comes in on a humanistic level. And I think that part made me very uncomfortable.
I'm just a soul trapped in this circuitry.
In fact, I think it horrified me. for a number of reasons. Hmm. What I realized was that I could not get from this AI-generated song was, I guess, this immense sense of history, which cannot be separated from the blues, which, if you look, goes all the way back to the horrific institutions of slavery and oppression. You know, history is just one of the things that it's just not there in this, and how important history actually is to the music that we make. So this feels like a very capable parrot that's able to, you know, on the surface, create, I mean, albeit very impressive technically things, but it's actually missing something I would call, I don't know, soul. And I think that bugged me, you know, and it's certainly not the first time I've listened to AI-generated music. The AI systems of today, as impressive as they might be, is they don't know anything, and that actually matters. That matters about the music and the meaning of music. If I just want to be entertained on a rainy day, that's different. But I think the music that matters to each of us is the music that we feel like understands us.
So, I mean, obviously musicians have concerns about their livelihoods, especially if they make commercial music, but not only. What other kinds of concerns have emerged amongst musicians in light of the progress of AI systems and especially AI-generated music?
I think it goes beyond livelihood, right? I think the fear isn't just that as artists, we're going to be replaced. But not only are we going to be replaced, we'll be replaced by something that's far more generic and far less interesting. And the world will be okay with that. You know, that's a horrifying scenario to not just musicians, I would say to any creative who feel like their craft is not just this getting replaced, but it's getting replaced by something potentially much more generic. Because if you listen to really what generative AI is doing, at some level, it's very serviceable. It's occasionally astoundingly serviceable. But is that what we want from art? You know, I don't think we don't just like, oh, wow, the concert went to that was so serviceable. Right. No one says that.
Right.
What we want, I think, is something we might call the sublime.
Yeah. And just finally, to end on maybe a more optimistic note, what current or future opportunities do you think that human-computer interaction offers us when it comes to music creation and performance beyond AI-generated music?
Human-computer interaction, I think, is actually a celebration of humans. And I think human-computer interaction is saying that actually, you know, it's recognizing that we are not just brains in jars moving through this thing we call life. I know there are people who probably can't wait to get rid of this inconvenient, messy, imperfect thing we call a body. And they can't wait to just actually, I don't know, become brains in jars. But there's a lot of us, and I would count myself in the second group, who think like, yeah, this imperfect, frail thing we call a body is what gives rise to this thing we call the human experience. It's how we sense, it's how we move, it's how we act. And HCI is, I think, for me, is a fundamental recognition of that. You know, it's kind of been this dream of technology, it seems, that, hey, wouldn't it be nice if the thing we thought just materialized? It's kind of like in Star Trek, The Next Generation, it's, you know, they'd be like, computer, make me a sandwich. And a sandwich like materializes, and it's purely product. And so it's like now we're closer to that than ever before. So it seems, right? If we can think a thing, we can then put it into language. We can use a language to prompt an AI system that's going to give us an image, a song, you know, a piece of writing. But to me, as someone that works with HCI day in, day out, I'm thinking there should be room to explore that, to explore kind of this, like, how do we get what's in our heads out there and to have a form in the world? But that shouldn't be the only way that we can interact with the world, with technology. You know, in fact, I would say, like, this idea of, like, just being able to describe a thing you want and have the thing materialize is, to be frank, I feel like that's probably, like, the least imaginative way I can think of interacting with technology as a human. If you think about the world of musical instruments, there's so many different ways. You know, there are knobs that we turn, there are strings that we pluck, strings that we bow, there are membranes that we strike, there are things that we twist, that we turn, all these things that we do with our bodies. So on a philosophical level, I think this is why HCI is absolutely an exciting front and something that, you know, when paired with AI, gives insight both into what we might actually want from AI, but also it might inform us as to how do we build more interesting, playful, humanistic systems with AI in it.
Yeah. Gah, thanks so much for your insights on this.
Thank you, Nora. Thanks for having me.
Gah Huang is an associate professor of music and computer science at Stanford University. He's also the associate director of Stanford's Institute for Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence.
You are listening to Spark.
Machines do what they're programmed to do. They don't need incentives or rewards to create new content.
This is Spark
from CBC.
Historically, songwriting has been used as a form of storytelling through words, poetry, and song, a way to cope with our realities, channel our inner thoughts and feelings, and document our lives, the good, the bad, and everything in between. Through these moments, whole genres of music were born. But how does artificial intelligence challenge what music is for and the importance of lived human experiences?
My name is Inango Lumumba-Kasongo. I'm a rapper, I'm a producer, and I'm an assistant professor of music at Brown University. And I go by the name Samus when I'm performing.
I'm kind of scared of the academy. I think that my parents are proud of me.
There's a long-standing history of hip-hop artists using emerging technologies to create new sounds.
The genre has always had this kind of forward-thinking relationship with technology, sometimes as a matter of necessity and, you know, sometimes as a matter of innovation.
In a way, the turntable has come to symbolize that relationship. The pioneering producers and MCs of hip-hop's early years would use record players to extend segments of songs, musical moments they thought were worth sampling or repeating.
Like James Brown records that they were listening to and other artists whose records that they had grown up listening to through their parents, but wanted to create kind of an innovative way to engage with those forms.
By extending these moments on these records, they also created opportunities for dancers to interact with these sounds in a way they couldn't before.
And so by thinking about the turntable technology as its own kind of creative form, as a way to remix and revise, these early hip-hop innovators were already playing with the idea of how we can break sonic technologies to create new possibilities.
And that kind of experimentation has continued on to today.
You know, autotune did not emerge out of a hip-hop context, but it's been hip-hop artists who have largely been engaged in playing with it for purposes that extend beyond what it was initially created for, which was to pitch correct if somebody was in the studio and they missed a note. Instead, so many hip-hop artists have engaged with it as an instrument in itself, so much so that it almost has defined the genre in many ways, like many popular artists are defined by the sound of autotune. So there's always been this sort of playful, sometimes transgressive relationship with the tools and technologies, particularly in the sonic world, that we think should work one way. And the artists who come from this hip-hop space say, like, well, what if we bent it or broke it or exploded it in this way?
So given that history of these innovative and in some cases sort of subversive uses of the technologies, how is this moment of generative AI different from previous periods of technological transformation in hip hop history?
Yeah, I get this question a lot. Often, you know, I'll have folks who might attend talks or even, you know, my own students who will say, wait a minute, you know, sampling is kind of this foundational piece of how hip hop expression, how rap expression has evolved. And AI is essentially this, you know, giant sampling mechanism, right? It allows us to take from global wealth of knowledge and produce new outcomes. Isn't this very much replicating that mode of expression and that mode of engagement? And I think some of the ways that I might push back are tied to scale. So when I think about a producer who's digging through the crates to find a particular record and hunting for samples and kind of finding innovative ways to repurpose that sample, a lot of the value of what that sample is that it can be located back to its source, right? Like the way that a producer expresses their ingenuity in many ways is by having us as listeners recognize what the source material was and see how the producer reworks it. And so I think that there's this really interesting intergenerational dialogue that hip-hop innovators are invested in in which the transparency is key. The transparency about where the source is key to our understanding. I think in the AI context, that transparency, at least emerged in the hip hop context, is not at the core of how many of these companies are thinking about the role that AI should play in our society. We might have a sense, for example, that a thing sounds like or looks like XYZ person, but we don't have a relationship with the material that was used to kind of train that data set, right? Many of these companies are very, you know, have not sort of had that sort of transparent relationship with us as listeners and viewers. And so I think the scale at which AI companies and developers are able to think about that extraction means that this sort of conversation between a producer and another artist is not possible first, but also is not prioritized. The conversation that takes place between the person who has sampled a track and the track that was sampled, or the person who produced a sampled track, can sometimes be, don't sample my track, mm-hmm. right? That's one version of a conversation that can happen, but that's still a conversation. And I think with AI tools, the way that these systems are set up precludes there even being a discourse right. between kind of maker and creator and listener. And so that's one of the ways I would say it feels quite different.
Mm-hmm. So we're familiar with this idea of algorithmic bias in AI. It's something that we've talked about on the show quite a lot in areas like security and healthcare. But can you talk to me a bit about how those biases manifest in AI music technology?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, one easy way to think about that question is to have folks, for example, think about a West Coast beat and have them maybe describe that sound. We all have particular ideas about what that means, what that is, what sort of like sound effects might show up in that type or style of music. And of course, that's shaped by countless artists having a relationship with a particular set of instruments and particular set of artists and producers. And that does create something like a sound or a feel that comes from a particular region. But what happens when that becomes reduced to kind of a set of parameters that I can type into a system to say, give me a West Coast beat. And now I'm given back a song or something that I'm listening to that has been trained on a very particular set of songs from a particular moment in time. And it's now being fed to me as sort of a universal West Coast sound, right? So it can be limiting in a lot of ways. I think for music making tools to be legible to users and makers, there's a sense that I should be able to type in a set of parameters that I want to be able to have reflected back at me sonically. So I want a West Coast sounding beat at X beats per minute. And the idea that the system will share something with you that's built on sort of, again, a very particular set of sounds from a particular region and moment, but that's not explicit, can then lead to these sort of biases or ideas about what it means to produce a sound from the West Coast and preclude creative possibilities, right? That if folks are sort of new to the space, don't have a relationship with the history and the geographies of how sounds are moving and developing, there's a way in which having that shorthand sort of stand in for a whole set of musical practices means that the sort of research and nuances around understanding how that genre moves and grows are lost, unless you're sort of someone who's willing to do the deep work of listening to a whole bunch of different kinds of artists and trying to think about ways to break sort of our understanding of what a quote unquote West Coast beat might sound like in our sort of cultural imagination.
Mm-hmm. So there's an aesthetic limitation, but it sounds like there's also sort of a more political limitation that you're getting at here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot about risk when I think about these sort of music making technologies, which is not often, I think, a word that's associated with AI in the context of creativity. But I think about who can afford to absorb and risk and take risks in the creative space. I say that to mean, when you show up to the blank page or you show up to the computer or your beat pad to make something, there are certain certain kinds of risks as musicians that you might take, things that deviate from what we hear on the radio or what we know to be popular, the chord structures that we know are effective in this particular way. And that's shaped largely, I think, culturally, like what we prioritize, what we say we prioritize, what shows up as being popular, I think in many ways can shape the creative process and the way that we show up to those spaces. So if we're in a society where we have many tools that are invested in averaging, you know, this kind of sound or this kind of sound, the sense that risk is an important thing to bring into the creative process, I'm worried will be sort of greatly impacted.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In his book, The Book of Rhymes, The Poetics of Hip Hop, Adam Bradley writes, and this is a quote, "There just aren't enough words in a given pop lyric line to fill up a rap bar in the way we've come to expect," meaning that there's more essentially speech data per line in a rap song than in other popular genres. So what are the implications of that when it comes to AI?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because when I first started thinking about this question of how are hip hop and AI kind of interacting, I wasn't necessarily thinking structurally about like what are the particular formal elements of hip hop that might render it vulnerable to these systems in ways that other musical forms might not be. And I teach a rap songwriting class, and so I've been teaching Adam Bradley's work for some time, and that quote kind of stood out to me this, you know, more recently as I've been thinking about AI as a structural component of hip hop that might render it more vulnerable to these systems in terms of data mining, because there's so many words per line that show up in the hip hop context in a way that sung speech doesn't necessarily always convey in kind of the pop context. So there's a certain kinds of information that I think rappers are prioritizing in thinking about words as serving rhythmic and informational capacities. Another one of the concerns that I have is that the basic sort of structure of how rap music is composed also puts it as sort of a potentially vulnerable kind of musical form to be engaged first in these conversations.
Yeah. And just finally, where do you see promise in the use of machine learning and in large language models in music, if at all?
Yeah. I mean, there's a few different ways that I won't say that I'm excited, but I will say that I'm curious about some of these other possibilities. And I do think one of those is around authorship and our ideas about the importance of sort of a single author, the way that culturally we value that and how that has impacted so many artists negatively. And so I would really be excited to explore possibilities where artists would not necessarily feel beholden to saying, I'm the genius who made this. Like if they can be freed of the anxiety that comes with having to be the brilliant innovator who made this piece. And I think that this extends beyond just the music world, that in many ways are sort of like individualistic, the singular genius mythology that guides so much of art making has made it a really challenging space for folks to maneuver through. And of course, that's related to our economic models. Like we have to know who made this so we can know who to pay. But I am curious about what it might look like to explore new systems that allow us to give over our sense or belief that we should be the sole genius of this. Like I often tell people, when I write a song, it's just as much a product of my mom's as it is me. It's just as much a product of all of the folks that I've listened to as it is me, the things I've read, the people I interacted with at the coffee shop. And we don't have a way to account for that. And so I'm curious about what a system might do to us culturally if we have to give that up. You know, of course, I want people to be compensated, and I hope we can come up with structures that do that. But I am interested in the cultural imaginary around what it means to displace or to collectivize authorship in ways that account more for what the real creative process is, which is like pulling bits and pieces from all the things that we know and hopefully giving it up as this kind of offering. So that seems like something cool that can maybe shift some of our perceptions about what's most important about the creative practice.
Yeah. Fascinating. And Anongo, thanks so much for your insights on this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Inongo Lumumba Kasongo is an assistant professor of music at Brown University, a rapper and chief rap officer at Glow Up Games. And we enjoy that conversation so much, she's going to be back on next week's show. You've been listening to Spark. The show is made by Michelle Parisi, Sam-Marie Johannes, Megan Carty, and me, Nora Young. And by Deirdre Lockridge, Tom Allen, Ga Wong, and Inongo Lumumba Kasongo. Special thanks this week to Samir Chopra and the Spark Family Players. Subscribe to Spark on the free CBC Listen app or your favorite podcast app. I'm Nora Young. Talk to you soon.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.